I think with Bitcoin, there's been ups and downs. We've also had the speaker yesterday joke about it a bit. But I think it's going to be interesting to hear what Imran's going to say today about Bitcoin, the future of Bitcoin, and how it will be impacting the financial services sector going forward. So he's going to do his talk, and then we'll have some time for questions at the end. Thanks, Imran.
Cool. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry to disappoint you, but this talk is going to be about everything but how you can make money on Bitcoin. So it's going to be more about the technology and the usefulness and how it's going to impact financial services. So I'll ask a slightly different question to Neil. A lot of people maybe have invested in it, but how many people used Bitcoin and actually did a Bitcoin transaction? Okay, so not so many. And how many people, obviously, especially the ones who've lost money, how many of you think it's a scam or a bubble? It's a complete waste of time. Because I was actually hoping there might be more people like that, but maybe if you think it's a scam, then you're not gonna come to one of these talks. Okay, but now I'm gonna start. But instead of talking about Bitcoin, I'm first gonna tell you about something else. I'm gonna tell you about. Is this thing working? Is this thing on? Working? Instead of telling you about Bitcoin, I'm going to tell you about. If you guys would one of you guys mind helping me? Oh, there we go. Yeah. Instead of that, I'm going to tell you about 56K modems. So before the days of the internet, when we were connected online, we had to use these things to get online, and you had to actually dial it through a phone line. And so one of the things about this is that I grew up in the 90s. So I actually got to see the internet go through many stages of evolution. I got to see, when I was a kid in school, my parents got me and my brother one of these. And, we used to browse the internet all the time, go to websites, download stuff. But here's the thing about the internet in those days. It sucked. It was very slow. 56K modems took forever to load web pages. It was very difficult to find anything because search engines didn't work like they did today. And the setup was extremely complicated. You had to go through configuring IP addresses and MAC addresses and whatnot just to get online, and then your mom calls somebody and the call hangs and you get kicked off. But it only took about 20 years before we got from there to, where do I point this thing? Over there? There we go. Before we got from there to here. So this is my nieces and nephew, and think about this. They will never grow up in a world without the internet. So it's like air to them, they breathe it. And I think when it really hit me and my wife how far the internet has come was when our oldest one, who's 8, she started sending us emails. And the youngest one, who's 4, she can't read, but she can use YouTube and Netflix. So it's something I want you to keep in mind when I go about this talk, is that even if something seems very, very complicated now, even if it seems like nobody gets it, people are very negative about it, it only takes 20 years, it only takes a while before we get here. Sorry, you got my clicker? No, do you mind? Technical difficulties. Cool, so, wait over there. Okay, great, so, rather than tell you what's cool about Bitcoin, let me show it to you. So, if I had to give any of you my email addresses, you can send me a document, you can send me a file, you can send me a video. You can send me pretty much anything. But can you send me R5? So you can't, right? You need my bank details, and it takes 2 days through an EFT, and it's quite a process involved. But you can if you are using Bitcoin. So if you think about it, it's actually quite strange, because why is it that we can send anything on the top, but we can't send money? Because money actually is just another kind of data. So only 7% of the rands exist as physical notes. The rest are bits in a computer. So why is this data different to other data? Well, like I said, it isn't if you're using Bitcoin. So I'll just take you through a transaction. Sorry, can you tell me where do I point this thing? There we go. So I'm going to take you through a typical transaction I do with Bitcoin. So in case you didn't know, Take a Lot accepts Bitcoin. And so I bought this book called The Bitcoin Standard. It's a pretty good book. You guys should check it out. What you have to do is you hit proceed to checkout. You choose pay fast. And then, like they showed us on... Sorry, I'm really struggling with this thing. Do you guys have a replacement or... Can I... So yeah, one of these QR codes will come up. Like, you know, like they showed us on Alipay or WeChat. You scan this with the phone app. And then there you can see there's the amount and there's the fee. And you hit send and it pays. So on a very basic level, what Bitcoin can do is replicate the function of a credit card. But so why would you go to this double and use this new system? What does it offer you? One of the key differences between this and a credit, well, there's a few key differences. Is one, there's no sign-up involved. So to get a credit card, you have to get a credit check and you have to go through KYC and you need to have a bank account and all that. Bitcoin works on the same principle as an email. You download an app and you can start using it. The other thing, and we'll go a little bit more into this later in the talk, is that it's a bit more secure than a credit card. So with a credit card, you have to put in your card number and that gets stored on servers, which means that it can be hacked and then the money can get stolen. But with Bitcoin, and again, we'll go into this later, you can pay in a way that doesn't reveal confidential information about yourself. And the third one is that the settlement happens in 10 minutes, whereas the credit cards happens in 2 days. So funds will get locked, but the merchant will only get it in about 2 days. But is that enough to get people to learn this new complicated technology with all of the baggage that comes with it? And the answer is no. This is not going to change. This is not the reason why Bitcoin could be successful, but this is what Bitcoin could do 10 years ago. So the technology has come a long way since then. And let me show you what Bitcoin can do today. So this is a website called Satoshi's Place. And how it works is it's got 1 million pixels, and you can paint one Satoshi to paint one pixel. So Satoshi is 1/100,000,000th of a Bitcoin. It's a very small amount. And as you can imagine, when you give people on the internet license to paint whatever they want, they paint all kinds of weird and wonderful things, and most days the site is not so safe for work. I actually had to censor it a bit. But if you want to see the uncensored version, Satoshi's Place. So I found myself a nice little spot over there, and I wrote a message that I thought was important to share with the world. And after that I hit submit, and then another one of these QR codes comes up. So another time. It's 9:40. So I scan the QR code on my phone app, and then it's again payment sent, still 9:40, and there's the message. And it's still 9:40. So, oh, and for doing this, I paid a nice round number, zero. So let me tell you what just happened. I just paid someone 1.5 US cents. Now, 0.5 cent is an amount so small it doesn't exist in our financial system. You can't send 1.5 cents. But you can, and I did it so instantly. They got the money in the same minute, and they're able to spend it. I did it globally. These people are in another country. And I did it at near zero cost. This is called the Lightning Network. This was launched earlier this year for Bitcoin. It's still in development. It still has kinks to work out. But this is the reason why I'm excited about Bitcoin. Global commerce. And the rest of the talk is going to be me explaining how all of this works. So I've kind of got two definitions for Bitcoin that I'm going to structure my talk around. The first one is that Bitcoin is a new technology to transfer value instantly and securely without third parties. And that is going to be the technical part of my talk. That's going to be the first part. What is Bitcoin? How does it work? And then, there we go. And the second part of my talk is going to be structured on this definition, which is Bitcoin is the world's first global money and unified payment network. And that's going to be the more business side of our talk. How does it affect us in financial services? Why should we care? So let's start. Firstly, how Bitcoin works. This is much better. So the way I see it, there are four fundamental technologies behind Bitcoin. And these are blockchain, peer-to-peer networks, proof of work, and cryptography. And if that sounds like a buzzword soup, don't worry, we're not going to talk about any of that. Instead, we're going to talk about how Bitcoin has a distributed ledger. We're going to talk about how it's decentralized. We're going to talk about the economic incentives that underlie the system. And we're going to talk about security. And since security is arguably the most important feature, let's start with that. So Before I can tell you how Bitcoin improves in the current system, what is the current system? So this is a credit card. It's not my credit card. It is a credit card. And the credit card's got three security features that we care about. It's got card numbers in the front and back. It's got a magnetic strip. It's got a SIM card. In security terms, we would describe the credit card as having a very large attack surface. So what that means is that if you're a hacker, you love this thing, because if you copy the numbers in the front and back, you can steal money. If you copy the magnetic strip, it's not encrypted, so you can steal someone's money. And the SIM card is a little bit more tricky. That you need a PIN code to unlock. But then you need one of those physical card reader thingies, so you need specialized hardware. And you also need to be in the same place as the person you're doing the transaction with. So not suitable for online purchases. And it's because a credit card is so insecure that we have about $22 billion every year in credit card fraud, which is more than the GDP of some countries. And it's also the reason why my bank sends me emails like this, where they tell me people are going to skim your card and take the magnetic strip, and people are going to get your card number and spend without your PIN. And it really doesn't seem to be getting better, because this is my favorite one. This is new. It's called Tap to Pay. Do we get sound? You get the picture. So credit cards are not exactly getting more secure over time. How does Bitcoin solve this? In Bitcoin, there are two basic security features you need to care about. There's the private key, and there's addresses. And you can think of the security model as very similar to what we already know with email. So anybody can send an email to an address. Anybody can send Bitcoin to a Bitcoin address. But only the person with the private key or the password can actually access the Bitcoin in that address or access the email in that address and send the email from that address or send the Bitcoin from that address. So let's say I wanted to do a hypothetical transaction with with Peppa Pig. How it would work is I'd find out what Peppa Pig's address is, and I'd send the Bitcoin to that address like I would an email. And then here's the important part. I will sign that transaction with a digital signature. So you can think of these digital signatures kind of like the combination lock to a safe. If you try and guess what the combination is to a safe, you're not going to get anywhere. But if I tell you what the combination is, you can plug it in and the safe will open. And then you can verify that I gave you the correct code. And in Bitcoin, I think you can try and crack this and guess the right signature for the right transaction. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think you have a higher probability of winning the lottery 9 times in a row and then getting struck by lightning on the way to collect your winnings than cracking one of these codes. And if you had 1 million of the most powerful computers, it would take you longer than the age of the universe. So this is pretty secure. I mean, it's called the elliptic curve digital signature algorithm. It's all math, and you guys are actuaries, so go check it out. It's interesting stuff. But what it means in layman's terms is that if you get a digital signature and it's valid, without a bank, without anybody else, you can verify that signature by checking that it's valid, and then you know that you got paid, you know it's not fraudulent, you know the money is coming, you don't need a third party or bank to verify that payment. But now, that's between me and Peppa Pig, and how does everyone else get to know about this transaction, that Peppa Pig actually has this money? And this is important because of a problem we have on the internet that doesn't exist in the real world. And this is what it is. So in the real world, you have scarcity. If you give someone a music CD, I now lose the CD and Peppa Pig has the CD. Copying has a cost. So it's not a simple matter of just, there's a physical scarcity on every physical object that you give someone. On the internet, that doesn't apply. You can copy an MP3 and send it to Mickey Mouse and Jon Snow, whoever you want to. 1 million copies if you want to, and you still have the MP3, which is a problem if you're dealing with money. Because what stops me from copying like 1,200,000 notes and becoming an online millionaire? Well, this is the double spend problem, and we do have a solution to that in the current era. The solution we have right now is you put the banks in charge. So you have one party or a group of parties centrally controlling the ledger, and what they will do is whenever there's a transaction, my bank will get in touch with Peppa Pig's bank. And between the two of them and the central banks and the clearing houses and the payment processors and all of the hundreds of parties that get involved in this, they will make sure that all the debits equal all the credits, no new money is created or destroyed, and when I transfer to Peppa Pig, everything works properly. And this is part of the reason why the system is costly and why it takes so long to reach these settlements. So how does Bitcoin solve this problem? That takes us to the next part, which is how Bitcoin is decentralized. So how Bitcoin works in a different model. When I do a transaction to Peppa Pig, both of us will tell everyone we know, and they will tell everyone that they know. And within about 20 seconds, almost everyone in the entire world on the Bitcoin network will know that I paid Peppa Pig. They'll know that Bitcoin has been spent. You can't spend it again. They'll know to update the ledger. And most importantly, they'll have that digital signature. So with that signature, they can verify it's a real payment. It's not Peppa Pig trying to steal somebody's money. Peppa Pig has those Bitcoins and I don't. And any one of these computers can verify, anyone can run one of these, and they're called nodes. So they're distributed all around the world. Anybody can run a node if you want to give up some bandwidth and download the software. In fact, if you look over there in South Africa, you can see a nice cluster over there. I'm in there somewhere as well. But what these nodes do is that Bitcoin's solution is that instead of putting one special party in charge, you put everyone in charge. So every single person can run a node. Anybody who's running a node can verify, can check, can maintain the ledger. Everyone keeps a copy of the ledger. Everyone checks everybody else to make sure that nobody's cheating. So this is appeared to be a network. But it doesn't solve the double spend problem on its own. Because you see there's something pretty sneaky I can do. So what I can do is I can pay Peppa Pig, but at the exact same time, I send a Bitcoin to Jon Snow. Now, Jon Snow knows nothing. He doesn't know. So he doesn't know that I've already spent this money because he sees the signature and it's a valid signature. So how this is going to play out is that when we broadcast these transactions to everybody, half the network is going to think the Bitcoin belongs to Peppa Pig, and the other half is going to think it belongs to Jon Snow. And when these two sides of the network talk to each other, they're going to fight. Because the red ones are going to say, you guys are scammers, that Bitcoin belongs to Peppa Pig. And the orange ones are going to say, no, you guys are the scammers, the Bitcoin belongs to Jon Snow. And this is not a trivial problem. This problem went unsolved in computer science for, I think, about 20, 30 years. And the problem is, how do you get a bunch of computers computers that don't know each other to reach a consensus without putting someone centrally in charge? And the solution to that, you probably heard of, it's called blockchain. So blockchain gets talked about a lot. I think it was mentioned in the opening plenary. I'm not going to go into detail on how exactly it works. I'll give you kind of an overview. And part of the reason is because I don't think blockchain is the most interesting or important thing about Bitcoin. And if you want to know more, there's a lot of resources out there. But fun fact about blockchain, the guy who invented it is the same guy who invented Bitcoin. So blockchain was invented by an anonymous person on the internet, and we have no idea who they are. This is broadly how it works. So the ledger is not one long Excel file with a whole lot of transactions. Instead, it's a bunch of smaller files, and these files are called blocks. So you can think of these blocks as just that every one of them is another page in a very, very long bank statement. I think we're on block 550,000 or something about now. So that's just another page of transactions that have happened over the last almost 10 years. So when transactions are made, they go to these waiting lists, and everyone kind of keeps their own waiting list. And every so often, someone will come onto the network and propose a new block. They'll say, let's update the ledger, let's add a new page of transactions, number 500,001. And they'll go to the waiting list, and they'll include some transactions. And then once it gets included in year, then everyone can download the latest block 500,001. They can check all the signatures and make sure it's valid. And now all of these different computers are on the same page. They're in synchronization. They agree on which transactions happen in what order. And then when the next block comes along, everyone who's ever creating that block will see, know that Bitcoin has been spent, and it won't get included. But now, you can see that with this system, whoever is creating these blocks has a lot of power in the system because they get to decide transaction order, which is more or less a saying they get to decide who gets paid and who doesn't. So again, this is the thing. One is that blockchain on its own doesn't actually solve the double spend problem. You're still kind of left with this issue of who creates blocks. And the solution to that is called proof of work, or a lot of people have heard of mining. So I actually think mining is a pretty bad metaphor because these guys are a lot more like bookkeepers or accountants. They maintain the integrity of the ledger. So how it works is like this, and this is probably the most important thing about Bitcoin, is that who can propose a block? Anybody. Any one of those nodes that I showed you earlier around the world can propose a block, and if you choose to do so, you're called a miner. And so let's say you were to propose block 500,001, you'd go to the waiting list, and you'd include these transactions. But now, you don't get to just put your block out there onto the network and everybody has to agree to it. You first have to do some work, and this is you have to solve a complex math problem. So now you don't actually have to solve it yourself with a pen and a paper. Your computer will do it for you. But the idea is it's another one of these combination locks. Very complicated to calculate. It takes the network about 10 minutes on average to compute the next block. But anybody can plug in the solution, verify it, and confirm, yes, this person did the work. So they spent electricity and time and hardware. And now why would anyone do this? Why would anyone go through this hassle of spending computing power to create blocks? And the answer is that there's money involved. If your block gets accepted by the network, if you're the first one to do it, you get a mining reward. So you get paid some Bitcoin, and this is how new Bitcoin enters the system. And the economics of this is a bit beyond the scope of the talk, but if you're interested, get me in the questions and I'll go into more detail on that. But you also get fees from the people that you include. And again, so now you might be wondering, so this is how we decide who gets to create these blocks. You have to commit some work, but why would we go through all of this trouble of making you have to spend electricity and computing power to update the ledger so everyone can say synchronization? And the reason is this. There's a fundamental asymmetry at the heart of Bitcoin that doesn't exist in the current financial system that makes the whole thing tie together, and it's this. Fraud is expensive, but verification is cheap. It takes 10 minutes for everyone on the network to create a new block. 10 minutes of electricity, hardware, computer power, resource, all of that. But it only takes 1 second to verify a block and check all the signatures and make sure that it's a valid block. So what that means is that if you're a scammer, if you're trying to come to the system and, you know, spend Bitcoins that have already been spent, or create Bitcoins that didn't exist, or take fees that aren't yours, you're going to lose a lot of that money. Whereas if you maintain the ledger honestly, you'll get paid. So the honest miners, the ones who maintain the integrity of the system, they get paid. And the ones who try and cheat the system or try and commit fraud, they go broke. They lose their money. They lose their hardware investment. They lose their electricity and time that they spent. And kind of how the system is structured to work is that we always follow the ledger that has the most number of highest difficulty problems solved, the most proof of work, the most work has gone into producing that ledger. So a lot of people think that blockchain is immutable. They think you can't reverse it. But it actually is. You can reverse it, and you can reverse it if you can solve more problems than everyone else, which means that if you want to defraud the ledger, you would have to solve more problems than everyone in the entire world who's mining honestly and still have enough of an advantage that you can sustain it over a very long period. So it's economically unfeasible to change the ledger. It hasn't, in 10 years that Bitcoin's been around, it hasn't happened. And over time, it's become more and more difficult as more people mine and maintain the integrity of the system. So Bitcoin is, for all intents and purposes, irreversible. Now, if I bring it all together, all of this stuff, what I was kind of saying with how it works is that we use the cryptography is there to make sure that you can pay somebody else and they can verify it. After you do these transactions, they get distributed on a peer-to-peer network. Everyone on the network stays in synchronization using this technology called blockchain. And the blockchain itself is secured by a process called proof of work. And all of this comes together so that I can write nonsense on the internet. And that's why I say at the start of the talk, Bitcoin is a new technology that you can transfer value instantly and securely, and most importantly, without third parties. But I think there's a simple explanation for that. Bitcoin is a new financial system. And for the implications of that financial system, that we're going to talk about in the second part of my talk. Cool, so everybody still with me? If you lost, now's the time to find yourself, because this is the really important part of my talk. I came here to tell you this part. I told you that story so I could tell you this one. So let's jump in. I said at the start that Bitcoin is the world's first global money and unified payment network. So what do all of those words mean? So with money, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to assume that Bitcoin is money because I can use it to buy stuff and take a lot. if somebody's willing to accept an exchange, I can use it as money. But there's a lot of interesting stuff on here, and if you want, you can get me in the questions, and I'll go into some more detail. I got some slides on the gold stand and whatnot. But I said it was a global money. What do I mean by that? I mean it's a global money in contrast to the current system of money we have, which is boarded. So this is a trip I did earlier in the year. I went to Dubai and Thailand, and I came back. And across 7 cities, I had to do 6 currency conversions. I had to go from rands to dollars to baht, back to dollars, to dirhams, back to dollars to rands. And at every point of conversion, I had to pay a fee, I had to seek out an exchange, I had to fill out some KYC protocol, big schlep. But in all this time of all of these currency conversions and inconveniences, my email address didn't change. You could still get hold of me whether I was in Phuket or whether I was in Dubai. Same email address, same way to contact me. No hassle. Now, imagine if we had a system where you had to have a different email address for every place you went to. So we used to have a system like that. It was called The Post. And I don't think anybody still uses that as their main medium of communication. Bitcoin operates on the same principles as email. So regardless of where I was, no matter where I was in the world, I had complete access to my Bitcoin. I could receive money, I could send money, could do transactions. Bitcoin is not boarded money because it doesn't exist anywhere. It's not held in a bank somewhere. It's on the internet, on the cloud. It operates on the same principles as email. It's everywhere. Now I said it's a unified payment network. What do I mean by unified? So in order to explain what I mean by unified, let me tell you what happened with email, how email unified the different mediums of communication. Before we had email, you had to use a different method of communication depending on what kind of communication you were sending. So if you wanted to send text, you want document, you've got to use a fax machine. If you want to send audio, you've got to use the radio. If you want to, put video, you can send it on a TV, but you can't receive. And then email came along and replaced all of that. So email is data agnostic. It doesn't matter what kind of data you want to send, you can send it using email. And as a result, a lot of friction has been reduced from the system. The costs have come down. It's much easier, much lower technical complexity in the end for end users to send information. And I think that Bitcoin does the same thing for money. This is what our current system of money looks like. We have different payment networks for every scale and kind of payment. If you want to pay someone small transaction, cash. EFTs, if you want to pay an institution or a larger amount, and that takes about 2 days to settle. Earlier this year, I tried to send someone money in the United States, and it was going to take about a week and cost about $1,000 to send the money. And we have a lot of systems depending on whether you're a government or a bank or whatnot. But with Bitcoin, you can do everything. So me personally, on Bitcoin, I've done transactions to individuals. I've done transactions to institutions. I've done transactions with merchants. I've done transactions locally. I've done transactions globally. I've done transactions that are worth 10 Rand, that are worth 10,000 Rand, and that are worth 10 cents. And I've done it all on the exact same system, using the same underlying technology. And as far as Bitcoin is concerned, that's just movement from one address to another address. So in the same way that email unified the systems of communication, I feel like this technology can unify the systems of payment, make it a lot simpler, remove a lot of the friction. But now a payment network is only as good as the number of people using it. No point if nobody's using it. And so I got the slide over here. And the orange is the daily value of Bitcoin transacted on the Bitcoin network. So every single day on the Bitcoin network, people transfer value between each other, and this is how much. And it's a bit difficult to see because it's an exponential. That's the log graph. So every jump is order of magnitude 10. And you can see that in about 2010, it was about $10,000 a day was moving on this network. And then at some point in 2013, it was over $1 million. And as of 2018, over $1 billion goes back and forth between addresses every single day on this network. So a lot of people tell me, Bitcoin is dead, Bitcoin's over, but as far as the usage goes, it is the highest it's ever been in Bitcoin's history. Over $1 billion, goes back and forth on this network every single day between accounts. And people always ask me, should I invest in Bitcoin? Must I buy? And my answer is, I don't know. I'm not here to give investment advice. But what I can say is this. As Bitcoin has been more and more used by more and more people, its value goes up. And that's simple supply and demand argument. The more useful it is, the more people want it. And what is the concern? So I'm not saying it'll go up forever, but assuming that people continue to use it, it will keep getting more valuable. And part of the reason why I believe that will be the case is something called Metcalfe's Law. So Metcalfe's Law, most people are actually familiar with it, but maybe don't know it by this name. It's that the value of a network is proportional to the number of users squared. So if you have a network with 2 users, you have 1 connection. If you have a network with 5 users, 10 connections. And 10 users, 45 connections. So it's a quadratic. I think it's like n minus 1 over 2. But the basic idea is that networks become more powerful exponentially the more people actually use them. And this is one of the reasons why you see why you can't just create a new social network tomorrow and outcompete Facebook, because it's much easier for everyone else to join, for you to join Facebook and be connected to everyone else, than it is for everyone else to leave Facebook and join you on your social network. And this is why over the last 10 years we've seen Bitcoin, the more people use it, the more people want to use it. And this is also my argument for why a lot of people ask me, should I invest in, I've heard about Bitcoin, but what about this other coin? They have a colorful name on the internet, but I'm not supposed to swear, so the not so good coins. But these coins, if you look at the transaction volume, not even comparable. Ethereum, I think, is the second biggest competitor to Bitcoin. It doesn't even do 10% of Bitcoin's daily volume. The rest are peanuts. So Metcalfe's Law, the more people use it, the more people accept Bitcoin, the easier it becomes for the next person to accept Bitcoin. And that's why I said Bitcoin is the world's first global money and unified payment network. But again, now, why should we care? What does that mean for us specifically? So let me take you through a bunch of case studies and show you what it means for us. It's that right now you think you have free markets. You think you can go to the supermarket and buy Heinz chili and All Gold Light. But here's one decision you can't make. You can't decide whether to conduct that transaction in South African rands or US dollars. If you're in South Africa, you have to accept rands. It's the law. You've got to pay your taxes in rands. You've got to receive payments from your customers in rands. But thought experiment. If you were given the option by your company to receive your salary in different currency, how many of you would take US dollars over rands? Okay. How many of you would take rands? How many of you would take Zimbabwean dollars? So not so many. So all I'm trying to illustrate with this example is that as far as currencies go, people, you have some level of preference. You are not completely indifferent to what currency you're receiving. But you're essentially being forced to pick one particular currency. So you're forced to buy this when you may want this, which is a suboptimal choice. And that's more or less the same as being forced to buy this when you want this. And if we really be honest with ourselves, who really enjoys light tomato sauce? But the impact of making a suboptimal choice is well understood in economics. And the moment you take away those barriers to making the suboptimal choice, people make entirely different choices. So we got to see that already with the internet and media. So in the old days before the internet, and media was bordered and local, we had to watch South African news channels and watch the African TV shows, and we had to go to South African cooking courses. But today, when you take the borders off, we can watch international news channels, and we can watch international TV shows, and you don't need to pay for a cooking course. You can learn directly from someone free anywhere in the world on YouTube. And in most of these cases, the costs have come down, the quality, the service, and the options we have arguably improved. So when you remove the barriers, people's choices change entirely. And for an example of what this could be like, I've already got a company that is operating in the Bitcoin economy, and it'll show you something interesting about what happens when you move this new system. So this is a website called Bitrefill, and that's my phone number, so don't use it to send me spam emails and stuff. But how it works is that you type in your phone number, and then you pay with Bitcoin, and you get airtime. But here's the cool thing about it. They support over 700 operators in 160 countries. This slide's a bit outdated. As of recent check this morning, they've now do 700 operators in 160 currencies. If they wanted to do this on the current system, you would need to have support for 160 different currencies. But this is how business works in the Bitcoin economy. It doesn't matter where anyone is in the world. If you agree on the currency, you can do business. So I'm in South Africa. Bitrefill is in Sweden. But I can buy airtime for my nieces in Saudi Arabia if I want to. They can receive the money, with the Light Network, instantly, give the airtime, no banks involved, no third parties. I mean, that's pretty cool. And this kind of thing, when you operate in this economy, is going to change a lot for how financial services works. And it's going to change the dynamics that exist between companies and customers and governments. And one of the best examples that I can show you of this is a company that already did this called Binance. So who here has heard of Binance? Okay, so at least a few people. So Binance is the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange. They did about $200 million in profit in Q1 of this year, which is higher than Deutsche Bank, which is a 146-year-old bank. So these guys are not small players. And they were based in Hong Kong until recently, and they were getting fed up with the way that the Hong Kong regulator was taking a certain stance on cryptocurrencies. So making it very hard for them to do their business and the reporting. And so they decided to leave. They went to Malta. But here's the interesting thing. They were the first company in history to leave and take their customers with them. So I'm over here. Binance was over here. They moved halfway across the world, and nothing changed for me as the end consumer. The same Binance, I used them a week or two ago, exactly the same service. And this is a game changer, because this means that for the first time, governments are actually going to have to compete with each other. Malta is going to have to compete with Hong Kong to provide the most productive environment for business. And if they don't, the cost of leaving is only going down. I mean, how many local insurance companies can say that if they were forced to move for any reason, that their customers will follow them? But when your payments are global, it doesn't matter where you are. And for an image about this kind of thing, it's not just governments that are going to have to adapt to businesses. Businesses are also going to adapt to global customers. And one of the best examples I have of this is somebody local, our friends DSTV. So I don't have a DSTV subscription. I've got a Netflix one. Part of the reason is because it costs a fraction of the price. So DSTV, for 30 years, when media was boarded and local, had a monopoly. They could charge whatever they want, provide whatever service they want. And then the internet came along, all the borders went away, and now Netflix and Showmax and anybody can come from anywhere in the world and provide a service. And they can do it at a fraction of the cost. And DSTV have done the noble thing. They've complained to the regulator, said, you know, please save us. And I think probably the only reason that they may still be in business is because of sport. But tomorrow, if someone has to come and offer sport on a platform like this, I mean, who knows? And that's why today in the financial industry, we're still operating in a bordered economy. This is how the world looks from my perspective. I've got a local insurance company, and I've got a local asset manager, and I've got a local bank. And that's all local, all bordered, all because finance is bordered. But in the future, who knows? Because if my email provider is sitting in California, and my exchange is in Malta, and my phones get made by people in Korea, why can't my bank be in China? Why can't my insurance company be in France? Why do I have to invest in a fund of fund with Satrix? Why can't I go directly into Vanguard's funds? So if you operating in South Africa as a boarded company, which you have to currently, you just have to worry about this. And if you expand it to Africa, then you have to worry about this. But I'm saying that soon, you're going to have to worry about this. And the world is a big place. If you take one thing away from my talk today, just you can forget the rest. It's that the internet came for media, and now the internet has come for money. And there is one saving grace. We're still in the 56K modem days. It's still very difficult to use Bitcoin. It's still very confusing. But it doesn't take long before we get from year to year. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Imran, for that insightful talk. Any questions? Hands? Hey, cool. Demba?
Yeah, the mic is coming. There, yeah.
Thank you. Yes, thanks for that talk, Imran. Temba Gamedze. My interest is in, you mentioned the Bitcoin exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember, the issues about security have arisen at exchange level. Could you just, I don't even really understand what a Bitcoin exchange is and why there's a security issue there.
Sure, so I can go into some more detail on that. So one of the consequences of Bitcoin removing third parties is that you don't need a bank anymore to hold your money. So you can get an app called a Bitcoin wallet, and you can keep your own private keys. And that means that you have your own money. Nobody can take it away from you. Nobody can spend it. You don't need anyone's permission to do a transaction. But along with that, it also means that if you lose those keys, there's no Gmail to reset your password. So people have lost Bitcoins. And one of the biggest problems in user adoption is that a lot of people are scared of holding their own Bitcoins because, at the moment, it's still difficult to secure your passwords, but there's a lot of functionality that's coming with encrypted backups of your passwords and whatnot, but for now it's difficult. There are some devices that make it a bit easier, but a lot of people facing that complexity choose instead to go into an exchange, or they store their money on a website like Luno. So these companies, you can think of Luno and Coinbase and these exchanges as kind of like banks. They will hold your Bitcoin for you and protect it for you. But that also means that your Bitcoin falls under their responsibility ultimately. So there have been cases where they can block you from withdrawals if they want to. And because it's not as regulated a space, there aren't as clear directions as with a bank. But also if they get hacked and your money gets stolen, it's the same thing as if a bank gets robbed. But yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges to making Bitcoin easier for people to use. It is getting better over time. There are some devices called hardware wallets that make storage easier. But yeah, does that answer your question?
Any other questions?
Thanks. It was a very good talk. I enjoyed it.
So
one thing I never quite understand about Bitcoin, I understand you explained what people are looking for, faster transactions, more security, low transaction costs. But I don't see why we want a currency stuck in the middle of that. If I want to pay locally, I want to pay ZAR to ZAR, and I want it to be fast, secure, and low transaction costs. If I want to pay internationally, I want to pay ZAR to US dollars at a fair exchange rate. I want it to be fast and cheap and low and secure. Why do I want Bitcoin at any point?
Sure. So that's a whole section. That's actually a very interesting question, and a whole lot of this whole section that I guess you could say I didn't talk about. But there probably will be in the future some products coming from the traditional banking system that will allow you to do that. Probably. I mean, a lot of them are studying the technology behind Bitcoin, and I think it's probably inevitable. I don't know how long it'll take, but we'll probably able to do that. But the real, sort of for me at least, one of the biggest things about why you would want to hold Bitcoin rather than holding ZAR or another currency is that I didn't go into this in the talk, but it's a currency that can't be debased. And what I mean by that is that because you have all these nodes watching everybody has to follow the same rule set. And if anyone deviates from that, they're going to kick you off the network. So that means that nobody really controls it. Nobody can really change the rules. And there have been some interesting fights in the Bitcoin community about this, but ultimately, nobody can really go against what is the consensus. So one of the consensus rules is that there's 21 million Bitcoin. Nobody can create more beyond that. It's about 20,000 something, something, something. So one of the reasons why you may want to hold Bitcoin, or why anyone may want to hold Bitcoin as opposed to a different currency, is that right now it's extremely volatile and people don't trust it. But over the long term, it may be a more stable store of value than the other currencies. So, sorry, do you mind jumping to slide 88? So, here is sort of a measure of the purchasing power of the dollar over 100 years. And part of I didn't go into this in detail in my talk, and maybe we can go into this afterwards, is that the central bank control of the money does have consequences. And one of them is that the dollar's lost 95% of its purchasing power over a very long period of time. I mean, we've kind of seen the same thing with South African rands. We've lost about half our value over the last 5 or 7 years. So one of the advantages is that you're holding something which is scarce and that nobody can actually print more of. Yeah, which specifically in countries like Zimbabwe and Venezuela, that's been a lot more attractive than the local currency that they've had. So more so in the poorer countries where the currency is not as controlled, that's where it's had the highest utility.
Any other questions? Maybe a question from me.
Sure.
You said the costs of transactions is quite low. I did a bit of Bitcoin arbitrage myself.
Yeah.
But likewise,
yeah.
But the transaction cost of that is huge. It's like 5,000 rand type of transaction.
Was that on Luno?
Between Luno and Bitstamp.
Yeah, so
I managed to still, so even though you pay that much in transaction costs, yeah. Made a bit of money, luckily.
Sure, so I can comment on that. So yeah, I was also one of the guys arbitraging when that happened. But anyways, on the cost, that's another consequence of what Tembo was mentioning, is that if you store your money on exchanges, they can charge you whatever fees you want. So I've sent a lot of support emails and complaints to Luno that they tend to charge a very, very high fee relative to what the market is. So I didn't go into these dynamics as well, but it differs. If you're doing a transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain, you have to pay for it. And it depends on how urgently you want that transaction to happen. So if you want it confirmed within the next 10 minutes and you want to pay a high fee, I mean, it depends on how many people are using the network at a given time. So in December, the fees were quite high. Right now, after one of the network upgrades called SegWit, the fees have dropped. So I've been doing high priority transactions for like a rand. You can do low ones for like 20 cents or lower. But the fees thing is a concern right now for like wide adoption. And again, with exchanges, they can charge you whatever the fee they want to. So Luno claims they're charging a network fee, you know, based on the network. But I've seen the network a lot of the time, what the actual fee is. They're definitely making a profit off their customers. With the Light Network as well, so this is a new technology that's going to be built on Bitcoin. You're going to be able to do the settlement. You're basically going to be able to transfer the money but pay a much lower fee. So for that Satoshi's, that Satoshi's Place transaction, I paid nothing. I think in total, over something like about 100 transactions, I paid less than like 10 cents, South African cents. Like, so technology is also improving over time.
You know, there at the back.
Oh, hi, Imran. Thanks for the talk. What happens as you get to the end of the supply line for Bitcoin? Will the network fall apart? How would proof of work continue to work?
Do you mean when the...
When you get to 21 million, does the network fall apart?
So how it works is that it's over a very long period. So it's gonna take until, I think, 2142. Because how it works is every 4 years, the number of Bitcoin you get from mining halves. So it used to be 50, and then it was 25 Bitcoin per block, and now it's 12.5. And it will keep going for about over 100 years, and then hit zero. And kind of the long-term view of Bitcoin is that over time, the fees that the people pay to transfer on the blockchain itself will replace the mining reward. And we've kind of seen that happening slowly over time. So the idea is that the fees that people get, that people pay to be included in a block, will slowly replace the mining reward. But then also, in order for that to avoid people paying extremely high fees, you move a lot of the transactions onto like higher layers. So one of the interesting things about studying the internet is that there's something called the stack. There's a lot of sort of layers before you actually get to the, you know, data moving. There's like a transport layer, and you know, there's like a communications layer. And the idea is that Bitcoin would work in a similar way. You'd have the base layer, which is the blockchain, and you build a whole lot of layers on top of that that people can transact on. And it would all get consolidated and settled on this blockchain, and those fees would pay for the mining reward. But that's given that we've never seen a system like this, it's completely a new experiment. We're going to have to see how it plays out over time.
I just have a question about regulation and taxation. Mm-hmm. Are there any regulations in place for some countries? And at what point will governments have to start taxing these transactions if people are getting paid in bitcoins? Do you need to declare it anywhere in the world? And also, can you comment on the opportunities this cryptocurrency creates for money laundering? It seems like the perfect currency to, you know, for the black market. What securities and regulation will there be for that?
Cool. So I got two questions from that. First is kind of about the regulation, and the second is about money laundering. So for the regulation part, I mean, I've struggled a bit with this as well, because I find that So it doesn't really work like anything we've had before, because Bitcoin is at once a payment network, but also an asset, but also a currency. And the current regulatory framework is very confusing, and it doesn't really fit what happens. So, I mean, I've used Bitcoin to buy books and coffee and stuff. Now, that's a Forex transaction. Do I have to pay capital gains on that? But if I buy it and sell it to do arbitrage, is that... So currently what's happening is that a lot of countries are taking a very hands-off, wait-and-see stance to classifying it or coming up with a regulatory framework. I mean, SARS has kind of done something similar with the tax rules. But what's been happening in the US is that businesses have been trying to push for more regulation and saying, can we regulate the space? Can we come up with a framework so we know we're not breaking the law, that kind of thing? Like, there's been a couple of dozen companies wanting to launch a Bitcoin ETF. And the regulator, I think, is being very cautious and saying, look, we need more time, we need more time. So there's a lot of regulatory uncertainty around the whole field. And as a result, a lot of people, like you could say, in the developed world, are very skeptical to start doing business with it, and then subsequently aspects of it fall under some regulatory framework they're not prepared for. But then what happens is that, like I said earlier, you can move. So Malta has taken a stance of putting a very like positive cryptocurrency set of regulations up. So a company called Blockstream, they've got an office there, Binance has moved there. Now what happens is that when you have a very, you know, either your regulation is too complicated or it doesn't work, a lot of people can just move elsewhere because you're a global business. So I think regulators are also going to be faced with that tension. So we're going to have to wait and kind of see what happens. As for the money laundering thing, so one of the things I didn't go into is that Bitcoin is not actually completely anonymous. So because you have a public ledger, every transaction is recorded on the ledger. And so if I pay Peppa Pig, you'll see a bunch of numbers and digits, which doesn't tell you that I pay Peppa Pig. But subsequently, years later, if somebody can link that transaction to me, they know I made the payment. So what happened, there's been a couple of instances of this already. You can Google a company called Silk Road. But they tried to create, a market on this, and they sold a bunch. You could pretty much list whatever you wanted. And some people started listing like illegal narcotics and stuff. What happened was the regulator was able to, the prosecution was able to, years later, by getting people to squeal and kind of thing, get them to say, you know, that was the transaction to me, and, you know, eventually shut down the market. And then the FBI agent who was investigating him, I think he stole the money. But then they caught him as well because it was on the blockchain. So I think Bitcoin is a pretty, like, as far as privacy goes, it is quite private if you use it in a certain, like, specific way. But if you're trying to do dodgy stuff, like, the best medium for that is still cash because it's anonymous, private, and fungible, and also no record. You can't be tried 20 years later for doing deals in cash. But with blockchain, like, stay forever.
Right, a quick question and then maybe just a quick answer from you because we've actually run out of time. But let's take that last
Hello.
One.
Hi, Imran. Vuyo Naganji at Allen Gray. Mm-hmm. One thing that I didn't see mentioned, I guess, was just the environmental sustainability from a proof of, work concept aspect. I mean, Ethereum uses proof of stake and the Ripples don't have mining at all. So I don't know what comment you've got from an environmental sustainability perspective.
Sure. So do you mind just jumping to slide 76 for me? Cool. So it's a pity you asked this question now when I'm running out of time because I feel like I could talk for half an hour on this thing. But what I can do is tell you that proof of stake is not a golden bullet. There's a lot of security holes that aren't addressed. But anyway, I think a more important question from the environmental side is not how much does Bitcoin use, but how much does it use relative to the current system. And so this is from two papers by a guy called Hass McCook, who's an Oxford scholar. He's got a bunch of papers. I strongly recommend Google this guy. His papers are available free online. He's written a bunch. And he goes into a lot of detail about the usage of proof of work, the actual carbon emissions of producing the mining equipment, of fabricating the silicon chips, like a lot of detail. It's good stuff. But the takeaway from this slide is that from the top one, this is more recent. Bitcoin recently passed over-the-counter gold settlement in daily transaction volume, and it does so using less O2 emissions than gold. And that's just gold mining. Bitcoin mining is the same as Bitcoin settlement. So it currently uses less than gold. And from if you compare it to the banking system, that's the one at the bottom. So this is a bit outdated. But even if you multiply the Bitcoin mining by 100 times, it is still using significantly less electricity than the current banking system, with all these offices and, you know, buildings, and that's not even counting the impact of like credit cards, which are plastic, and all the paper receipts. So I think it's an interesting question. I think that there's a lot to dig into there. We don't know the full extent because it's still unfolding, but there's a lot of interesting research out there you can go take a look at if you're concerned. We can also pick it up afterwards.
All right. On that note, Imran, thanks a lot for a very well-prepared talk.
And last thing, if you're on the app, please give some feedback. Cool. Thank you.